Live on DAZN Worldwide, May 2nd and 3rd, Garcia versus Romero and Canelo versus Skull. Friday from 6 p.m. Eastern, Garcia returns in a history-making Times Square takeover. 24 hours later, Saturday from 7 p.m. Eastern, King Canelo faces undefeated Skull for the undisputed crown. May 2nd and 3rd, a knockout weekend of boxing. Pick one or go all in for only $90 exclusively on DAZN. Buy now at DAZN.com/boxing.
Avoiding your unfinished home projects because you're not sure where to start? Thumbtack knows homes, so you don't have to. Don't know the difference between matte paint finish and satin? Or what that clunking sound from your dryer is? With Thumbtack, you don't have to be a home pro. You just have to hire one. You can hire top-rated pros, see price estimates, and read reviews, all on the app. Download today.
Going up.
Prices keep going up these days. It feels like being on an elevator that only goes up.
Going up.
But not at Metro. We're pushing the down button.
Going down.
We've lowered prices. Get one line of 5G data for $40, period. That's 20% lower. And you get a free 5G phone when you bring your number. Only at Metro.
5-year guarantee on eligible plans. Exclusions apply. See website for details. Not available at Metro with T-Mobile in the past 6 months. Tax applies.
If you're ready for a new job, let Express Employment Professionals help you. Express is already hiring for summer jobs in a variety of industries. Job seekers never pay a fee at Express. Go to expresspros.com to find your location. That's expresspros.com.
6:14, call it 6:15, if you will. Final day of April, and no surprise, it's getting warm, and it's going to be warm until, I'd say, maybe October. Not to be the bearer of bad news or anything, but highs today of 86. And as the phone continues to go crazy here, I'll tell you the rest of it in a moment. Highs today of 86, 87 tomorrow, 85 on Friday with a 45% chance for showers. Then, unfortunately, come Saturday, Jazz Fest, man, you're talking about an 80% chance for showers. So I don't know if that's going to be a washout or dodging the thunderstorms or whatever it is, or if it's going to be thunderstorms, but we'll talk about it as we get a little bit closer and get nailed down a little bit more. Then a little bit of a weak cool front comes through, high Sunday of 79, and that's going to keep the highs in the lower 80s until next week. It is currently 6:15, and I believe we're joined by Mark Hamrick, Bankrate Senior Economic Analyst, to talk about a new report and break down some things. How you doing, Mark?
Doing well, sir. Yes, believe it. I'm here. Good to be with you.
Thank you. Let's talk about, before we get to the job openings and labor turnover survey, lots been made about President Trump's first 100 days in office. People a lot of times see what they want to see, hear what they want to hear. I'm all about a bottom line dollar and cents kind of guy. I don't care about the politics. I don't care about red or blue. I care about green, and I care about my pocketbook and savings, et cetera. Is there any way to put a label or in any way determine what the first 100 days of President Trump's presidency have either helped, hurt the economy, too early to tell? Talk to me about that, Mark.
Sure. Well, you know, we're all about following the data. And at the end of the day, we have a collection of soft data, which is about sentiment or psychology, mostly on the part of consumers, but mm-hmm. CEO and business leader sentiment surveys. The small business trade group, NFIB, does its own survey. You have home builder surveys. And then you have the so-called hard data, which is, you know, measuring actual activity. Broadly speaking, and I'm speaking in the very broadest terms, a lot of the hard data has remained upbeat or, I would say in line with trends that we saw toward the end of last year. But it is really the sentiment data that is looking very, very weak. And so that's University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Survey. That's the Conference Board's Consumer Confidence Survey. And generally speaking, on the sentiment parts, it's about having a downbeat feeling about where the economy is and an even worse feeling about where it's headed. And so on the Conference Board's reading that was released just yesterday, consumer confidence made a fifth straight monthly decline and fell to the lowest level since April 2020. And we have to sort of remember what was going on in April 2020, which was when the economy was in a tailspin. Oh, yeah, okay. That's when we were really in the depth of the economic aspects of that. And the other part is that expectations are very weak. The measure of that is at the lowest since, and this goes way back, October of 2011. And then the other part is that people have expectations that inflation will not only persist, but actually become much more worse. Without getting into the weeds on what those measures look like, it's just that people, you know, had identified as inflation and elevated prices as the number one economic issue of the presidential election, and now they think it's getting worse than what it was before. And so that puts us in a bad place attitudinally, and we'll see whether the outlook, the reality of the outlook matches these concerns. So, you know, you have other areas like the job market. We've got a jobs report this week. It's expected to show a decline in, not a decline, but slower hiring on the month compared to the 228,000 jobs that were added in February. But the unemployment rate's expected to be at 4.2%. But I think the main thing about all this is that the real impacts of the tariffs have yet to be felt. How long they last, how long the tariffs stay in place, you know, it seems to be almost a day-to-day thing, but people are very concerned about the outlook.
So when it comes to the hard data of not, you know, we did this, they didn't do that, but prices, inflation, et cetera, have prices come down? Has inflation slowed?
I would say that inflation has really sort of steadied, but hasn't substantially improved. And so the Federal Reserve's main gauge of inflation is due out here shortly, and it's expected to rise at a year-over-year rate of 2.5%. So 2.5% is a lot better than 9%, which is what we had during the worst days of the pandemic-caused inflation. The consumer sentiment reading I just told you about, consumers are fearful that we're going to have a near-term inflation rate of 7%, which would be well above what we've seen recently. And so that is the concern, that taxes on imports are essentially present two likelihoods. One is higher prices, the other is slower growth. And that's in the event that it's actually available, that the goods are actually available to buy, because we're being warned by the retail executives that we may see some bare store shelves once again. We'll see. So, you know, the problem with inflation is we need to differentiate that from elevated price levels, because those latter price levels are the ultimate outcome of inflation. As prices continue to rise, it takes them to a higher level. Obviously, we've seen some declines in gasoline prices. We've seen moderation in food prices. But I don't hear too many people, let's say, in my day-to-day life, or certainly not from an economic analysis standpoint, saying, hey, you know, look at the bargains we're getting out there. That's just not part of the conversation.
So many people want to spin it one way or the other. The economy is great. The economy is not so great. The economy is a huge definition in and of itself, right? It's what is the economy to you? We'll take a break, pick it up when we come back. Mark Hamrick's our guest, our friend, Bankrate senior economic analyst. We'll talk about the jobs report, April jobs report coming up later this week. And also, I would ask you on the Oakland Art Jeweler Talk and Text Line, 504-260-1870, leave President Trump out of it. Just in general, what grade would you give the economy as it relates to you and your life? A, B, C, D, or E? And incomplete is not in there. You can't have an incomplete. A, B, C, D, or E as it affects your personal life? I would say, for me, probably a B. Plus, 622 traffic now, WWL. 624 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Apparently, I said A, B, C, D, or E. I don't know where the E came from. A, B, C, D, or F, what grade would you give the economy? I don't know where they came from. Mark, the text come in, and math is not my strong suit. What's that got to do with alphabet? I don't know. A plus says one text. Another one says B minus. Groceries are too expensive. Another text says, Tommy, the grocery prices are astronomical. Still, you go buy a few items at the store, everything is so high, it definitely affects my way of life every day, so I give it a D plus. And Mark, I'm somewhat insulated because, you know, I eat chicken breast, brown rice, and cereal, muesli cereal, which is like a bag of oats for a horse, and bananas and raisins. So my grocery list is pretty inelastic. I buy the same stuff over and over, so I don't really notice it. But when it comes to like grocery store prices, is that in a different category, or is there an amalgam of all of these things to say where grocery prices are?
Well, that's why I mentioned the Fed's preferred measure, which is personal consumption expenditures price index. And that essentially tries to talk about the year-over-year increase. But I think the more important thing is that if you look at the consumer price index, which is just another way of measuring the broad basket of all goods out there, including groceries, that continues to go higher. So, you know, we may say, or economists may say, or the Federal Reserve may say that, let's say, the inflation rate is down from before. That's really the month over month and year over year change. It's unless something precipitous happens over a prolonged period of time that we don't anticipate, those prices are always going to be moving up. You know, there may be some variations where, you know, you get a bargain on pork, you get a see a decline in chicken prices, steak doesn't ever seem to go down. But, you know, there are just some categories in the grocery store. Let's just say you do see some volatility in the grocery store, but, you know, we're also bracing for the impacts with respect to both Canada and Mexico, because we import the majority of our fruits and vegetables from those two countries. You know, we want to have our mangoes and our avocados 24/7, 365, and we don't have the capacity to grow all those things in the United States all year long. So so this will be something to watch, and we'll see how consumers react to things as they evolve. The container ship traffic coming into the West Coast from China is right now positioned to decline somewhere between 30% and 40% in the next few weeks. And so what I'm concerned about is that will have a ripple effect on trucking, because truckers typically are used to move those goods all across the country. You know, the ships can only go so far. And then, you know, what happens when that traffic and that those cargo shipments are not ending up on store shelves? You can imagine a series of domino effects where it affects, first of all, the truckers. You know, they're not going to pay those people to do nothing. And then the retail stores see a drop off in sales. And then maybe we see store closings if this persists. And the ripple effect then shows up in higher unemployment and lower hiring. So the stage is set for this to happen in the next few weeks. And I think we'll be talking about it to see just how it's affecting the economy that people are experiencing.
Hey, tariffs, has anything happened yet with tariffs? I know it seems as though the president imposed tariffs on automakers, but then he backed down. So I don't know if the art of the deal was he negotiated himself out of tariffs. I don't understand where we are on any of this. Do you know if we're the consumer, when, at what point do we start feeling the effects of tariffs? I know you alluded to it just now, yeah. But at what point do we know?
Well, you know, simply speaking on the auto tariffs, I think the impact of what was announced yesterday where they said there was a deal, and you're right, I don't think there was anybody on the other side of any table per se that there was an agreement made with. I think essentially what he said was we're not going to sort of stack tariffs where a particular car is going to be hit by multiple tariffs, but the tariffs of 25% on automobiles are still set to take effect, and we still have the similar situation with steel and aluminum, and you still have the broad range affecting dozens of countries where you have the baseline tariff of a minimum of 10%, including the famous island with only penguins and no trade, and of course the 100% plus on China. All those are, you know, right now, I think in this 90-day cooling off period, so to speak, and this is when we're supposed to have this, you know, golden age of deal making. But the reality is that trade agreements typically, broadly, take more than a year to be negotiated. So if we do get some that are actually in place in the not too distant future, that would be welcome. It'd also be a historical outlier. So we saw a lot of trade coming to the United States in the first quarter as companies tried to get ahead of the tariffs. There was a lot of automobile buying in the first quarter. But as those prices actually take effect at a higher level, you know, consumers no doubt will be cutting back if the current situation continues.
Thank you, Mark. Appreciate your time and your insight as always. We'll talk to you again soon. Mark Hamrick, our friend, Bankrate Senior Economic Analyst. We'll take a break, come back. Talk about some no new taxes sign that have been popping up in Orleans Parish. BGR says they might be misleading. We'll talk about it when we return. Right now, 6:30, time for WWL First News. 6:46, 14 till 7, going to be warm, and Saturday's looking rainy as it stands now. Let me go to a story here at NOLA.com, our friends and partners at NOLA.com by Joseph Cranny. Mysterious campaign signs cropped up around New Orleans that falsely attack a tax renewal from New Orleans Parish Sheriff's Office, leaving Sheriff Susan Hudson scrambling to correct the record before the referendum goes to a vote on Saturday. No new taxes, the signs, which don't disclose who made them, read in all capital letters, vote no on Sheriff's 10-year millage, election date May 3rd. But the tax that Hudson wants voters to renew is, in fact, not new. It has helped fund a significant chunk of the sheriff's office budget since 2014, and it wouldn't cause anybody's tax bills to go up. She says it's a lie, it's dangerous, does Susan Hudson. We'll talk to her tomorrow. And she says the office projects rather that the tax would continue collecting about $13.1 million a year, or roughly 20% of OPSO's operating budget. So what is good? What's bad? Where's the truth lie? I don't know. Let's go to the Bureau of Governmental Research and talk to our friends Becky Mowbray, who is the president, Rebecca Mowbray, president, I hope I can call you Becky, president and CEO of BGR, and Nate Pabon Trinidad, the research analyst at BGR. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. How are y'all?
Good morning, Tommy. We're thrilled to be here.
Thanks for taking the time. I don't know who wants to go first or if you two can see each other and give each other cues as to who's talking when or where or what. But Rebecca, I guess we'll start with you. And basically, what is this millage vote about?
Sure. This vote that would be this Saturday, May 3rd, is a proposal to renew a tax that has funded a portion of the sheriff's office budget for the last 10 years. It is a tax that would generate, you know, about $12, $13 million a year. And it supports operations at the jail. And it doesn't provide everything. It actually, the city pays for the lion's share of the costs at the jail, but it is an important baseline of funding, you know, to keep the jail running, pay for programs, operations, a certain amount of staffing, things like that.
Yeah, I've been doing this for a while, and I can't believe it took this long for the light to go off above me. But, Nate, you might want to check in on this or weigh in on this. Millages are never put on the ballot, I don't think, in perpetuity, are they? And as a result, they have to be renewed. And inevitably, when it comes time to paying for what people are already getting, opposition arises and it's viewed as a new tax when in fact it's not. Is that pretty much the nature of the beast?
Yeah, you're correct. Even in our report, we acknowledge that the 10-year lifespan, this if renewed, the tax would run from 2026 till 2036. This is pretty much in line with most property taxes in the state. We acknowledge this in the report. And yeah, it's been in the rolls since about 2015, about 10 years ago. And it would stay at the same level, 2.46 mils, for the duration of the next 10 years, if renewed.
So I think what people sometimes have a problem with is either transparency or tracking the money. They pay these millages and then they think it goes, and maybe it may, I don't know, that it goes into this big giant vacuum or whatever you want to call it, pool, this lake, pond, whatever you want to call it, and then it's never seen again. Let's take a break. We come back. One of y'all can address the transparency when it comes to sheriff's office and this millage and where the money's gone, and if for whatever reason the millage is not approved, what would the results be? And I don't know that. Do you guys take a position on it for or against, or do you just weigh in on what it would do?
Yeah.
Hey, Tommy, it's Becky. We did take a position in favor of this tax, largely because if it were to disappear, then the city would be on the hook for funding everything. And there's a lot of competition for money for things at the city. And historically, there's been a lot of friction between the city and the sheriff's office over the jail. And so if you have this base level of funding coming from the tax, at least it's something. And, you know, there's less competition for other funding from the city council.
We'll pick it up here when we come back. It just seems like a bad situation in general where the millage is there for 10 years, whatever millage it is, and then it has to be renewed. And what happens along those timelines is inflation happens, so the price of everything goes up. People get squeezed, so they don't want to pay any more. It's viewed as a new tax, so they say, nope, I'm not paying any more, when in fact it's just to pay for what they're already getting, the price of which has gone up. And, oh, by the way, you factor in politics, because the people that sometimes administer these agencies that collect the millages are elected officials, and then their popularity factors in all of this as well. We'll take a break, come back, continue our conversation with the people from BGR, Bureau of Governmental Research, about the millage for the Orleans Parish Sheriff's Office that's on the ballot May 3rd. Right now, let's pause and take a look at traffic on WWL. 6:58, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Quickly back to Becky Mowbray, President and CEO of BGR, Nate Pabon Trinidad, Research Analyst at BGR, about Susan Hudson and a property tax millage renewal that's on the ballot. I want to get to this text line if I can, y'all, because I was talking to an official yesterday about the intricacies of bond and a garbage contract and of a bond, and I realized a lot of people listening probably didn't even know what a bond was. So let me read a couple of texts here, and you can jump in where y'all feel comfortable, all right? Where's all the additional tax revenue from the Super Bowl and the Taylor Swift tax revenue? People ask that, so you can tell them that. And also, what about the money in tracking where it's spent? You got about a minute. Go ahead. Good luck. Thank you.
So in terms of tracking where the money is spent for the tax, that's actually one of our recommendations we built into the position we took in favor of it, which was the sheriff really needs to take initiative in reporting how the tax is spent, which historically hasn't been done as clearly, and just reporting to the public in general how the jail performance is doing and its progress towards improving it, as well as just improving long-term planning of funding for the jail and ways to get that funding by reaching a cooperative agreement with the city and the mayor. As far as the first question isn't really in our purview of the report.
Thank you.
But yeah, those are the recommendations.
Gotcha. I appreciate the time. We'll be back. WWL. 7:14, Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by our friend Joe Geruso, New Orleans City Council member. Talk about a lot of different things. How you doing, Joe?
I'm great. Good morning. How are you?
I'm all right. We had a story we're running about the surge in water board and the rain that happened and after the Monday after Easter. And I know you guys are going to talk about it today at the Council's Public Works Committee, but again, it seems like everything is fine until it rains. Then we got turbine problems and power problems, which I don't know if we always have power problems or they only occur. You see, here's a question, Joe. It comes down to, are the power problems exposed because it happens to rain a lot, and that's when we go back and look, and it's like, oh, well, if you had checked every day, you would have noticed we had a power problem. Or is it whenever you go to use the system to pump the water, it doesn't work, and that's why we know we have a problem? Thoughts?
Yeah, it's a great question. Mm-hmm. I think it has a lot to do with how much power you have to generate versus dry events versus rain events. And obviously, if it's not raining, there isn't as much power that's needed. And I think for a long time, we sort of talked about sewage and water boards, power needs, and what needs to be done. And of course, as everybody knows, you have the old power system, the 25 hertz power and the 60 hertz power. So you have two problems now, Tommy. One is you have an old power source that's outdated, and you have plenty of 25 hertz pumps. And then those pumps are powered in turn either by something like Turbine 4, which is 100 years old, and I'm not exaggerating when I say that. It dates back to World War One, you have those frequency changers that then can convert the 60 hertz power to the 25 hertz, but then how are you getting the power to where it needs to be? So it's a long way of saying the power issues become more problematic because you have to have more power necessary when it rains. You have to have power for 25 and 60 hertz when it rains. And because the system is old, it's hard to manage all that, which, of course, is why all of us have our fingers crossed so readily for the summer when the new substation and Turbine 7 come online.
So let me take a step back here, if I may, and that is when it comes to the pumps and they can handle, because here's the deal. Before the Cedric Grant flood, the infamous Cedric Grant flood, right, we were told the pumps can handle an inch an hour for the first hour and then a half inch every hour thereafter. I still don't know what that means, because that's like a 1 in 100 year rainfall kind of reference, because it sounds great, but what does it really mean? So it goes to what pumps are available at what area, what power's available at what area, right? So is that still an accurate statement, Joe, to say you're a smart man, you're an attorney, you do this stuff, you know, for a living? Is that an accurate statement to say an inch an hour and a half an inch thereafter? Because now we're back to saying, we got away from saying it, now we're saying it again, and I don't know what it means.
I think the statement itself is accurate, but then you added something on that has become the new corollary to the statement, which is important, which is, well, this is a 100-year rainstorm or a 10-year rainstorm. Mm-hmm. And what I keep on saying to Sewage and Water Board and to legislators is, hey, the reality is these 10-year rainstorms are not occurring every 10 years. They're occurring every year, sometimes multiple times mm-hmm. per year. So we have to maybe start talking about how we're changing certain things as we're.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
At MLBShop.com, you can get all the latest officially licensed merchandise for you and your family. But if you really want to level up your game, you can grab something for your dog walker, your Pilates instructor, your swim coach, your neighbor, your accountant, your gardener, your best friend, your bandmate, your boss, your kid's teacher, your mailman. Visit MLBShop.com and stock up on officially licensed on-field merchandise from your favorite teams.
Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
Every morning brings a fresh new energy.
This is Today with
Sophie. And no matter what the day holds, we come to the Today Show for all of it.
When things are tough, we talk about it. When there's something to figure out, we dig into it. And when there's joy, we celebrate it.
Because today is where it's all happening. We get the best start to every morning because we start it together.
Watch the Today Show with Savannah Guthrie and Craig Melvin weekdays at 7 a.m. on NBC.
Result of that, because the 10-year storm, the 50-year storm, the 100-year storm, they're happening with greater frequency than they used to. And so the whole idea of 1 inch per hour, half an inch is fine if the modeling is what it's supposed to be, but we're having those stronger storms that happen. I think Sewage and Water Board, and they'll correct me if I'm wrong here, but the storm that happened the other day when T4 went down, Algiers and Marrero and Gretna got something like 6 to 8 inches mm-hmm. during just those couple of hours. I mean, the system is just not designed.
Well, see, and that's the crux of it, Joe, and that's what I'm getting at is, well, then Turbine 4 doesn't matter. If it rained 9 inches, it doesn't matter. And that's where I get confused with this, because we have an after-actions report. Steve Nelson tells me Turbine 4, a really old piece of equipment, takes about 3 hours to get heated up, piece of equipment I can really only use if I know exactly when and where it's going to rain, which he doesn't. Nobody really does. So when it comes to the inch, an hour and a half an inch thereafter, that depends on the drainage. It depends on what gets into the canals. It depends on what can be pumped or what kind of power is available for the pumps to work. Are the pumps working? So I guess that just seems to me like a meaningless generalization, or am I wrong?
I don't think it's a meaningless generalization, but I think, again, you now, just listening to you, become an expert in the drainage system too, and you're hitting on all of
these points. You're not being sarcastic when you say that, right?
I'm not. Okay. That is said with absolute sober seriousness. Is that, look, you just identified the front part of the system, okay? So Susan Waterboard, in my view, has consistently been blamed for drainage issues that happen in the front. Catch basin that's blocked, the smaller linear line that's blocked. I mean, it's just like the plug in your bathtub. Mm-hmm. If you put that plug down in your bathtub, the water's not going to go anywhere. You lift it up. Now, that has nothing to do with power. That has to do with just pure gravity and movement and getting everything in the right spot. So if that doesn't move, that is a problem. So that's issue number one. Issue number two, as you're pointing out, I would argue, is the power issue. I mean, we've seen what happens both in 2017 and post-2017 when the power goes out. Remember, gosh, I guess it was close to last year, we had the boil water advisory when the balloon hit the line and the system tripped at Sugeon Water Board and the water pressure went down for a little while. That's a power issue. That's not a, it rained too hard, the drains were blocked, the lines weren't clean. That is a pure power issue, and the power is the problem. And then the last problem that you're pointing out, which is the one that's much harder to deal with and more expensive, is, okay, let's assume the drains are perfectly cleaned and the power is running like it should be, which should be the case this summer. Well, then if you get 6 to 8 inches of rain, then how do we deal with that? And that's the point where the system truly is overwhelmed, and you have to talk about just monumental wads of money to fix that, because it requires more pumping capacity, more retention of water, all sorts of systems. And I think that's the next place that we're moving towards. But we've been in such a problem, Tommy, because, again, you pointed this out, turbine 4 is ancient. A lot of the pumps are ancient. They use 25 hertz power. We're finally going to have a new power source for the first time in such a long time. There has to be conversion of the old pumps to the new power source. There has to be water purification. And then how do you start dealing with retaining water or making the system stronger as it is? And I guess that's going to be the piece down the road. We're kind of, in my view, the remedial mode right now. And then how do you get out of remedial to slightly more proactive?
Yeah, let me take a break. It just seems like every time something like this happens, we talk about this power being out or that power being out. However, meanwhile, back at the ranch, if it rains 9 inches, there's nothing you could do anyway. So I get confused about that. We'll talk about the pick to lead the surge in water board when we come back. Randy Heyman and your thoughts on that. He's coming from Philadelphia, and does he have experience, or does he understand everything that he's getting into, as we just outlined, talking to Joe Geruso, our friend, New Orleans City Council member, about the surge in water board drainage and when it rains 9 inches, I don't know what anybody can do. 7:23 traffic now, WWL. 7:28 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Joe Geruso, New Orleans City Council member. The Public Works Committee will meet later on, talk about the Easter Monday flood. Let's talk about Randy Heyman. Joe, coming from Philadelphia, thoughts on him as the new executive director of the SNWB?
Well, Mr. Heyman seems to have a wonderful educational background. Went to Michigan undergrad, Georgetown Law School. You know how us lawyers always push for other lawyers. But my one of my chief concerns is maybe twofold. Number one, I don't understand how none of the internal candidates made the final round of interviews. You just said yourself, Steve Nelson was on air.
He seems like the obvious choice to me, Joe, but go ahead.
Yeah, well, that's he seems like an obvious choice to be in the mix, and I don't know how you say he isn't. And also, Tommy, like, let's point out every time, basically in the last year to year and a half, there has been a hard media story. Steve Nelson's the one who, pardon the pun, has carried the water for Sugeon Water Board. And I just think they've used him a whole lot to go do the hard lifting, and then not to even advance him or Caitlin to the final round is disappointing. And the other problem, I think, for Mr. Heyman, we were discussing all of this sort of elliptically in the last segment, but to put a finer point on it, Sugeon Water Board is a state agency, which means you have to rely on the legislature. As of right now, the mayor is the chair of the board, And then you have the council that sets the rates, which means you have to be political and know how to get things done and work with people. And Mr. Heyman may be able to do that after a period of time, but he's not going to be able to parachute on day one when he starts and have relationships with the governor, the leaders in the legislature, and the council. And I worry because the needs are immediate, as we've been talking about, and the things that need to happen and how old the system is and just what the political climate is. That takes time. And it seems like we're kind of taking a step back, even if he has skills that are more frontward facing. Louisiana in general is just a different animal, and you got to be able to hit the ground running.
Thank you, Joe. Appreciate your time. We'll see how it plays out. We'll come back, talk about TOPS and how many students or fewer students are receiving it right now. A minute late. Time for WWL First News. 7:46, 14 till 8. Tommy Tucker, WWL. Kim Hunter Reed joins us, Commissioner of Higher Education for Louisiana. Good morning, Dr. Reed. How are you?
Good morning. How are you?
I am okay. Let's talk about TOPS. And before, you know, so many times we take things for granted that the audience knows. TOPS has been around for a long time. Maybe people know of it. Maybe generations in all the time it's been around don't know of it. So let's explain for the first thing, Doctor, if we can, what TOPS is.
Sure. TOPS is a financial aid program for students in Louisiana. It's a merit-based program. Obviously, Pat Taylor had a lot to do with the start of the TOPS program, the evolution of the program. His commitment early on was that if students were academically prepared, he would find a personal way to support them going to college. It evolved from a philanthropic idea into a state-supported financial aid program. Now serves about 50,000 students in Louisiana every year, undergraduate students, but you can use it if you have TOPS left over to go into graduate school. So it is foundational to the financial aid program that we have in our state to ensure that more students have access to credentials that will help them to support themselves and their families going forward.
Who can get it?
Students can get it if they are high school graduates, they meet academic requirements, and they are enrolling in schools in Louisiana. So it is designed to keep students moving forward. It is certainly designed to try to help us keep our best and brightest here. There are programs for students who are pursuing career technical education in a community college, and there are TOPS programs for students who are pursuing four-year degrees as well.
So it seems the academic requirements, they're not that stringent, are they?
No, they're a GPA requirement, an ACT requirement, and it's graduated based on the amount of TOPS. So there's a TOPS opportunity program for the base level of TOPS, but then there's an honors and performance program if you have a higher GPA or higher ACT. And then, as I mentioned, we also have TOPS Tech for students who are pursuing career technical education in a community college in Louisiana.
So it seems like not too long ago we were talking about funding TOPS, who can get it, who can't get it, is there enough money? Well, lately it seems like some money's not being used or not as many people are taking advantage of TOPS. What do the numbers show, Doc?
The numbers do show a decline in the number of people who are accepting TOPS, the number of people who are eligible for TOPS, and we've done some research on that. We do know that there are border states that are really cleaning our clock when it comes to financial aid packaging for students, a very competitive market right now for students. And so we do see students who are choosing to go to other states. We understand that, but we certainly want to be more competitive. We're concerned, Tommy, about students who choose not to go at all. We are seeing students who choose to go part-time because life happens. TOPS is a full-time scholarship program, so you have to be full-time to be eligible. So we're looking at student patterns, consumer patterns. The legislature certainly is trying to pass some legislation this session to make TOPS more competitive, but you're absolutely right. For many, many years, the TOPS program was growing. For the last 3 or 4 years, we have not had to request additional dollars. The TOPS program has declined.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back talking to our friend about TOPS, Dr. Kim Hunter Reed, who is the Commissioner of Higher Ed for Louisiana. If you have any questions or comments about TOPS, the Oconar Jeweler Talk and Text Line is open at 504-260-1870. Talk, text, data, message rates may apply. Please do not text and drive. 750, 10 till 8, traffic now, WWL. It is 7:56 and a half. I'm Tommy Tucker here on WWL talking to Dr. Kim Hunter Reed, Commissioner of Higher Ed for Louisiana, about fewer Louisiana students getting top scholarships. A couple of texts that are coming in here. Dr. Reed, you just hit a very high point. Border states giving our top students more money than LSU. They're getting more from Alabama than they will to go to school here. Somebody else said minimum ACT is 19, not fair to good students who don't excel in chemistry, physics, geometry, and algebra. Thoughts?
Well, two things I would say. First of all, obviously, we do have to make sure that we're more competitive, and we do have legislation this session to try to address some of those issues around the packaging, because as I mentioned, this is a competitive market. So I'm excited about the legislative conversations about upping our game when it comes to retaining our best and brightest. To the point about making sure there's a path, an affordable path for every student, that too is important. Louisiana has a need-based scholarship program, a need-based program, Go Grants. We have an adult financial aid program, MJ Foster. So it is true, Tommy, we have to make sure that if this knowledge economy is going to require certificates and credentials beyond high school, that there are paths for people to access those credentials affordably. So, yes, we're talking about TOPS, but we are also certainly are talking about need-based aid. We're talking about dual enrollment. We're talking about adult financial aid. That full suite of scholarships and grants are important for students, for sure.
Have they ever connected, or you all ever connected the dots with students that, as it relates to brain drain, right, with Louisiana, students that accept top money, TOPS money that stay here after they graduate?
We do look to see, are the students, I assume you're asking the question, do they stay?
Right.
Is that correct?
Yeah, pretty much. That's what I'm trying to ask, Doc, in my own clumsy way.
No. We do get that question all the time, right? Mm-hmm. Are we actually allowing students to get the credential and then providing them the job market that allows them to remain? Obviously, it's very exciting right now as we are announcing lots of new economic development projects. But you are absolutely correct. We have to make sure that the economic opportunities are there for our students. We want to make sure they're connecting early on with business and industry through apprenticeships and internships. We want to make sure that we are continuing to diversify our economy and lean into research that could allow us to spin off new jobs, new companies in Louisiana. So it's a full court press. It's not just one stovetop of education. It is an education to employment conversation that we have to have. But at the end of the day, more people need access to credentials of value beyond high school so that they can thrive, support themselves, and support their families.
Thank you, Doctor. Pleasure as always. Kim Hunter Reed, Commissioner of Higher Education for Louisiana. We come back, we're talking to Dr. Stephen Cantrow, Program Director of Pulmonary Critical Care Medicine at LSU Health New Orleans, about a strange kind of thing that happened in the Capitol with smoking last week. 8:16, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Before we welcome in our guest, I'll tell you my own personal story, which I've told before. My dad quit high school at 16, went to fight the Japanese in World War II. Because of the cigarettes were readily available, became a heavy smoker and spent the last week of his life, 69th, he was 69 years old when he died, which is very young, coughing up blood in and out of consciousness due to the COPD from the smoking. So for people that smoke and think, well, you got to die of something, and they think it's going to be a quick bolt of lightning that takes them out, I'm here to tell you, that's not the case, especially after watching him in a nursing home for 5 years before he died, that miserable death, not being able to breathe and so forth. With that, we welcome in Dr. Stephen Cantrow, our friend, Program Director of Pulmonary Critical Care Medicine at LSU Health New Orleans. Morning, Dr. Stephen. How are you?
Hey, good morning, Tommy. How are you doing?
I'm okay. Thanks for taking the time with us. I'm passionate about this because of the experience with my dad and realizing that it's not going to be a quick bolt of lightning when people casually say, well, you got to die of something. I don't think they realize what's ahead for them. That being said, politics and science always make for strange bedfellows, and that's what slapped me in the face when I saw this story about you going to Baton Rouge, Tyler Bridges has a story about it at NOLA.com. Tell me about it, Doc, in your own words. I just want people to understand what happened here.
Yeah, well, 10 years ago, I had gone up to testify. It's the only other time I've been to the Capitol to talk about, to testify for the tax increase that we were trying to get forward at that time, and that was successful. And there was an opportunity to come up and speak to that issue again this time. And so I drove up to the Capitol and got to participate in that discussion around two bills, one around taxing for vaping and one around an increase in taxation for tobacco. For those of your listeners who haven't gotten to go testify or go sort of see how the sausage is made, it's interesting. You know, I think my takeaway, actually, with a little time for reflection, is mm-hmm. that, I mean, I sat in the Ways and Means Committee. That was what met about this question of tax increases. And, you know, our representatives, this is us. These are actually really lovely people who are doing their best. But the issues are complicated. The science and the politics do intersect. And so when they were talking about vaping and the tax increase there, they were good questions from almost every single person in the committee. It was really a terrific discussion. It came to moving that bill forward with a positive vote for taxation for vaping, which is, of course, a really incredible problem, but not nearly as dangerous as cigarette smoking. And then the next bill that came up that had an opportunity to testify about was the one to increase taxes for cigarettes. And as your personal experience actually demonstrates very clearly, cigarettes are unbelievably dangerous. I read recently someone said, look, if you have a choice between vapes and fresh air, choose fresh air. Mm-hmm. If you have a choice between smoking cigarettes and vapes, choose vapes every day of the week, if you can really make that leap from cigarettes fully to vapes and not use both to increase your smoking. But smoking, Tommy, as your family experienced, this is a fact most people don't really appreciate, which is, if you're a smoker, there's a 50% chance you're going to die of a disease caused by smoking. If you are one of the ones who dies of a disease caused by smoking, you lose on average 25 years. That's about when your dad got sick, right? His early mm-hmm. 60s and then died
late
in his
50s, late 60s. Late 50s.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Right, right. So you lose, I mean, just in fact, you lose 25 years. I've got a friend diagnosed with lung cancer right now then who's battling this. And but what hangs in the balance is 25 years of life if you're a smoker and you're the half of smokers that end up getting one of those diseases. So, boy, this couldn't be a more important question. So I guess my observation from that part was that the representatives were terrific about the vaping, lots of fantastic questions. But when we got to the cigarette, I listened to the advocates speak, and then I had an opportunity to say something. I thought, wow, this is really kind of straightforward. And Representative Mandy Landry had put forward that bill, and I'd heard that she was going to actually propose an amendment to increase the tax that she had initially proposed of 33 cents, because taxes for cigarettes and for vapes, those change behaviors, certainly change behaviors. And for adults, you can do some back-of-the-napkin calculations, figure out how many people you could help quit smoking by increasing the taxes. So in the end, it was a kind of a brief presentation and then very few questions and then a vote against, which there's an opportunity going forward to do some really important work to close out what's been a century of cigarette smoking. It was a fantastic experience. I feel like, as I said, I've had a chance to reflect and think about kind of how our legislature works. And yeah, they're good people who I hope get all the right facts so they can represent us the right way.
Let me take a break, and I want to pick it up here. We come back quoting from our friend Tyler Bridges' story. You had appeared, Dr. Cantrow had appeared at the Capitol only once before, May 2015, when then State Representative Harold Ritchie, Bugalusa, Democrat, in his final year in office, sponsored a $1.18 per pack increase in the cigarette tax. Ritchie's move won notice because he had been smoking for 50 years and was suffering from emphysema and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, as did my dad. And we're going to take a break, Doctor. When I come back, I think two things jump out at me from here. when you get down the road of COPD and emphysema, then you realize where the dangers lie. But it's a little too late at that point, and all you can do is try to preach the message forward, which is what we're trying to do here. And I also want to talk about, you know, people think cancer and heart attack when it comes to smoking. I want to talk about what emphysema and COPD actually looks like in the final stages of life, or as we mentioned earlier, the last 25 years of life. 823 traffic now, WWL. 828, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Just a couple of minutes left with Dr. Stephen Cantro. Never enough time. He testified in Baton Rouge, heard about that. He's program director of pulmonary critical care medicine at LSU Health New Orleans. Doc, in about the 90 seconds that we have left, and I'm not trying to scare anybody, I'm trying to educate them. If they smoke now, cancer, heart attack gets the attention, but it's really the COPD and the emphysema. Talk about what the final years of your life are going to be like, if you will. I know because I saw my dad go through it, but just as a physician.
Yeah, you've lived those. But those are, you know, the definitely increases heart disease risk dramatically. But the two diseases that are most closely associated, I mean, these diseases almost wouldn't, they'd be very, very uncommon diseases without cigarettes, would be emphysema, COPD, and lung cancer. And lung cancer, when it comes on average, people live about 2 years or less after that diagnosis, one of the more aggressive cancers. The COPD unfolds gradually, and then it leaves you short of breath all the time. It leaves you struggling to breathe when you're trying to just move around the house a little bit. You're on oxygen. You end up going to the hospital, sometimes ending up on a mechanical ventilator. It changes your life in a dramatic way over those years to decades, depending on how long you can live with it. You have a risk of lung cancer that's higher when you have COPD too. So the COPD and lung cancer, they exist mostly from a public health perspective, mostly due to smoking. And at this moment, Tommy, this is actually one of the reasons I went to Baton Rouge, which is less than 1% of seniors in high school are smoking daily right now. It was 20% up until 2000. I mean, as long as most of us have been alive, it's been 20% or higher. And so people are not starting to smoke. That means in Louisiana, the 500,000 people we have that smoke, yeah, we need to help them one at a time or 50,000 at a time by increasing taxes. But half of them are going to die early. Very early because of diseases like COPD and lung cancer.
Doc, you got any resources anywhere people can go if they want to quit?
Yeah. You can Google for quit lines. Louisiana has quit lines. So quitting smoking, you guys, is actually not as hard as people think. There's 1-800-QUIT-NOW is really probably the easiest way to get contact with your doctor. Ochsner has programs, LSU School of Public Health has programs. But here's something important to know, which is, yeah, it doesn't have to be hard. In fact, when I meet people who are smoking, I say, look, I got a medication that will change your relationship with cigarettes. They'll stop tapping you on the shoulder and saying, hey, it's time to smoke. Let's just start varenicline. That's the number one best medication for this. It's well-tolerated. It's very inexpensive. Covered by Medicaid and Medicare. Louisiana did something great with this, which is it's covered by Medicaid, and it's not very expensive anymore. It's generic, varenicline. So you take that, it'll change the way you feel about smoking. That's a great way to start getting away from this problem.
Thank you, Doctor. Appreciate it. A minute late, we'll come back and talk to Cindy Nguyen about the 50th anniversary fall of Saigon, and we'll spend the rest of the show really talking about how that's changed America. Right now, time for WWL First News. 8:45, quarter till 9, Tommy Tucker, WWL. I'm looking at a piece of Associated Press wire copy here, sent from Vietnam, 4 o'clock on the 29th of April. This was the last chance for those Vietnamese who wanted to go. Rumors had it the Viet Cong would be in the city by morning. Streets around the U.S. Embassy became clogged with the last desperate Vietnamese trying for new life in the United States as against the regimented life they had been led to expect under communism. Cindy Nguyen joins us now, co-chair of the 50th year fall of Saigon Planning Commission, former city council member. Good morning, Cindy. How are you?
Good morning, Tommy. How are you?
I'm okay. Tell me your story, if you would, please, and how you came to this country and your journey.
Yeah. So I was 5 at that time, Tommy, and my father wanted us to have freedom, and he definitely did not want to live under the communist regime. And so he packed all of us up. Just whatever we had, we put it on our body. I came over to America with my parents, my older sister, my older brother, my little sister, and my mom was pregnant at that time, along with my grandparents and my aunt. We escaped by a boat. We were on a vessel had to be for days on the sea, just thousands of Vietnamese immigrants just trying to escape. We landed at Guam, where my father was advised that my little sister, Lorna, would not make the journey. She was really sick on the trip. And they told my father that it's best that we leave Lorna back at Guam so she could pass away and they would take care of her. And every time when I think of that story and I share that story, I still get tears in my eyes, Tommy, because Lorna is now 52 years old. Mm-hmm. She is has a master's degree in education, and she has three kids. And so just can't imagine. And for my father to be in that shoe to make that really hard decision on a journey where he had no idea where he was going. And I'm pretty sure he had doubts. But for him was the fact that Lorna had to be with us. You know, so if she was going to pass away on our journey to America, that her family is going to be with her. And so we landed in Arkansas. We landed in Arkansas and then was sponsored by a family in Monticello, Iowa, Tommy. Mm-hmm. And then from there, we moved to New Orleans because my grandparents can't handle the cold weather in Monticello, Iowa, and my father couldn't fish for a living. So we moved to New Orleans, where I discovered a whole community in New Orleans of Vietnamese immigrants through Catholic Charities and the Archdiocese, particularly Mary Queen of Vietnam, helped families to settle in New Orleans.
So let me ask you real quick, how close was it, Cindy, to the 50th anniversary in Vietnam? How close was it to the fall of Saigon when you got out?
We actually got out right before the fall of Saigon, so a few days before, and we were on our way to America already.
Tell me what for people that, like myself, that have lived here and nothing but freedom and never really been threatened by the loss of that. What is going through your mind as a 5-year-old? What is the feeling on the streets there in Vietnam, knowing that the enemy is approaching, that your freedom's about to be taken away? You're trying to get out of the country. I can only imagine the desperation, either as a parent or as a child.
Yeah. So for me, for a 5-year-old, I was really confused. You know, of course, you know, 5-year-old, you don't understand about politics, about war. You just basically and don't understand why I have to leave my home. But I saw in my parents, I saw in my dad's eye in reference to, and I saw he was very, he was fearful. He was nervous. I'm pretty sure it ran through his mind, like, am I making the right decision for my family? It was chaotic. You hear babies screaming. You hear adults just screaming for their loved ones. You know, because a lot of family was separated during this journey. I was very blessed that even though we travel with, you know, beaucoup of us together, we were all together. And that's something that I'm extremely grateful for.
Let me take a break. We come back. I want to talk about some of the things that are planned for today, about the commemoration, I guess, that's going to happen. And also about the influence of the Vietnamese in New Orleans and how I guess because of the French heritage of in Vietnam, how you guys kind of, I don't mean that pejoratively, you know what I'm saying, Cindy, how Vietnamese refugees fit so well into New Orleans. We'll pick it up here. We come back, 850, 10 till 9, traffic now, WWL. All right, 856, 4 till 9, couple of minutes left with Cindy Nguyen, co-chair of the 50th Fall of Saigon Planning Commission. Reflecting on her coming to this country at 5 years of age, days before the fall of Saigon, with her family, leaving a sister behind in Guam who they thought was going to die, thankfully didn't. Cindy, before we talk about what's planned with the Vietnamese-American community, talk about the assimilation of the Vietnamese community into New Orleans. And I guess it would be a lot easier for somebody from Vietnam to assimilate in New Orleans than maybe in a place like Iowa.
That's correct, Tommy, and because of the weather, and then not only that, many Vietnamese at that time fish for a living. Mm-hmm. And then especially when you don't speak the English language and you come over to a new country. And so it allowed, New Orleans really was a space that allowed us to, of course, acclimate to the weather, but most importantly for our parents to be able to start working immediately because we came over literally with nothing. Whatever we had on our body was that's all we owned. And so particularly for my father, he was able to go to fish for a living. And then my mother was able to go pick out shrimp. So that way to help the family, you know, at that time, Catholic Charity provided housing for us. But my father was like, listen, you know, we appreciate all the help, but we got to work, save up our money, and then own our own home because we don't want to depend on others to take care of us. And that's what we did. And leading up to this 50 year was creating a space for them to really reflect, Tommy, because I don't think my parents, along with others, had an opportunity to really reflect on their journey and talk about the pain and what they saw at that time. And so we're hoping that this 50-year commemoration is going to create that space for them. And then most importantly, to engage the community about the Vietnamese community. I hear all the time, you know, I don't know much about the Vietnamese community, despite the fact that we've been here 50 years. So, but there's never too late to learn. And I'm big on sharing culture and tradition with others.
As we have this conversation about immigration in a country, why do you think the Vietnamese people, and look, I'm making it a big group. Not, there are individuals, right? Everybody's different. The groups are predictable, yeah. Individuals are not. But why do you think Vietnamese people were so successful once they came to this country?
And so I believe what we, because we were basically, I guess, coming from a country, I came from South Vietnam, so in a rural area, we're, you know, working class in Vietnam, and so just the idea of saving and live within your means allow us to get ahead when we came to America, because I know that, you know, for the past 50 years, many Vietnamese have now excelled to being doctors, own their own business, you know, own their own construction company, own their own hotel. And so I think it's because of us, our cost-saving strategy. And I think there was, like, maybe rumors like, oh, we would have 10 people or 20 people live in an apartment just to save money. It is not a rumor. It is true. You know, that's how we used to save money, so that way we could get ahead.
But you know what? This is American. If you choose to do that, do it. If you're not Vietnamese and you want to live 20 people to an apartment, and as long as it's not against zoning and you're willing to do that to get ahead, do it. That's what America's all about, right?
Well, it's survival, you know, and I think it was our survival technique, you know, to get ahead.
Thank
and then
you.
Not only that, but we have family that were coming over, too, that we want to help.
Thank you, Cindy. I appreciate your time. I really do, and I'm glad you're in this country. Cindy Nguyen, co-chair of the 50th year fall of Saigon Planning Commission. We'll talk to a professor of history and learn more about Vietnam when we come back. Now I believe we're talking to a professor of political science and director of the U.S. Vietnam Research Center at the University of Oregon, Tung Vu. Good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. How about you?
I'm okay. Thanks for taking the time with us on this 50th anniversary of the fall of Saigon. For some context, how did the United States come to get involved in Vietnam?
Oh, the U.S. wanted to support the anti-communist regime government in South Vietnam, led by Prime Minister at the time, Ngo Dinh Diem. And Mr. Ngo Dinh Diem was a true nationalist, representing the wish of many Vietnamese at the time to stay away from communism. And so he was heading a government that aimed for that goal, to establish an independent government in South Vietnam from the communists. And the U.S. came to support him.
But the French were involved first, right? Or it was a French colony?
Right.
How did
US,
that... Tell me about the history of Vietnam, if you would.
So Vietnam was colonized by the French for about 80 years. Then came the end of Second World War. And the Vietnamese already declared independent from France. But then the communists who left the government came to... join the communist group, the communist camp led by the Soviet Union and China. So nationalist Vietnamese broke away and formed their own government. That was happening during the war with the French for independence. So anti-colonial war became a kind of a local anti-communist versus communist civil war.
When it comes to... the maneuverings of the United States to try to get out of the war. And I'm going to ask you a couple. I had a whole bunch of questions, Professor. I'm going to try to kind of get to the ones I wanted to since our time is limited. When it comes to, I remember as a kid, the president saying that he wanted peace with honor, but then President Nixon, but then if you look at what happened 50 years ago today, it was anything but honorable the way the United States left Saigon and Vietnam. And has history not shown that Nixon kind of kept the war going to help his reelection efforts?
That could have been the case, very well the case. But then there's still debate about whether Mr. Nixon really wanted to abandon the U.S. allies in South Vietnam. So Nixon made, you know, some really honest efforts to help South Vietnamese government, but then, you know, he got involved in the Watergate scandal and had to resign. So we don't know whether he, you know, he would have come to defend South Vietnam in its last hours if he had been in power.
When it comes to the negotiations, I remember a lot of, and I was just a kid for this, but I remember a lot of discussion about whether it would be a round table or a square table. Meanwhile, people were dying. Is there any way the United States could have won this war? Because, you know, the Vietnam veterans were treated terribly in this nation. Everyone I've spoken to have said that they weren't really given what they needed to win the war, that it was a crazy kind of thing where you'd lose lives to gain a bit of ground and then give it up the next day and then go back, do the same thing over and over. Talk about the U.S.'s promulgation of this war, if you will, and the way they went about it and why it didn't work so well.
Yeah, actually, I was a kid too at the time. Mm-hmm. I was 10 years old when the war ended, and I saw a few of the, you know, things that happened on the last days. But in terms of U.S. policy, the U.S. certainly made so many mistakes. So the war was not unwinnable, you know, like many critics say. But you know, winning here meaning defending South Vietnam and not, you know, taking over all of Vietnam, because defeating the communists in the north meant a different thing, right? Mm-hmm. So winning meaning defending South Vietnam, just like, you know, U.S. has been defending South Korea from North Korea, right? Mm-hmm. So it was possible, but U.S. made so many mistakes. U.S. leaders, you know, from Kennedy, who supported the coup against Mr. Diem, that was big, you know, a big game changer. That kind of, you know, caused the security situation in South Vietnam to deteriorate very, very quickly. According to, you know, North Vietnamese sources that I consulted, you know, I study North Vietnamese politics of revolution. And I read North Vietnamese sources, and in 1963, the Diem regime was not in any dangerous position at all. But then, you know, the coup changed all of that. So Kennedy made the serious mistake then, and then Johnson also made many mistakes, and then Nixon made many mistakes as well. So that, you know, in terms of U.S. policy, U.S. could have done differently, but, you know, that's how history happened.
One thing I've always wondered is when you look at what happened with the Korean War and the United States went so far until China got involved and said, that's enough of that. What role did the Chinese play in this war that the United States had with Vietnam, or police action, whatever it was called?
The Chinese played a huge role that was not known very well during the war. Mm-hmm. So they actually sent at some point 300,000 troops into North Vietnam to defend North Vietnam, so that North Vietnamese troops could go into South Vietnam to overthrow the government in South Vietnam. So, and the Chinese, you know, troops were helping the North Vietnamese defend the airspace, fighting against U.S. bombing, and so on. So quite a few of them died in the war in North Vietnam. So they really, you know, play a big role in the war, throughout the war. And, you know, even if once the U.S. already abandoned the ally in 1973, China continued to support North Vietnam with its tanks and artilleries and so many other things.
So what part did Laos and Cambodia play in this, or how did the United States get involved with that? And that brings us to the Mekong Delta, et cetera.
Well, Laos and Cambodia were used by North Vietnam to, you know, send its troops and material into South Vietnam. Without access to Laos and Cambodia, you know, the North Vietnam would not have been able to have a big role, to play a big role, or to wage a war in South Vietnam as it did. So North Vietnam was supporting Laotian and Cambodian communist troops and help them fight the royal governments in Laos and Cambodia as well. So U.S. came in to support the royal Laos government against, you know, the coalition of the alliance of North Vietnamese and Laotian communist troops. And later on, when U.S. and South Vietnamese forces invaded Cambodia in 1970 and 1971, the goal was to stop the communists from, you know, getting too close and, you know, maintaining a safe haven in Cambodia, so that, you know, whenever they were defeated in South Vietnam, they would withdraw into Cambodia, and U.S. and South Vietnam would be powerless to pursue them. But you know, like in 1970, you know, and 71, South Vietnam was able to do that because thanks to the support of the Cambodian government at the time.
One thing I do remember, and over 58,000 U.S. soldiers died, is that the argument, and it did, for people that think the nation is divided now, they have no idea. And I'm just remembering this as a kid, how divided the nation was then. Fathers, sons, people going to Canada to avoid being drafted. And it, I think, goes to the history of the nation and how different things would be with U.S. involvement were there to be a draft now and it not to be a voluntary military. But along those lines, the argument was proffered that this was to stop the spread of communism, and if we didn't make a stand here, that the entire world would fall to communism. What has history shown since then, especially, Professor, as it relates to Vietnam?
Well, I studied the Vietnamese Communist Revolution, like I said, and they were really ambitious, and they wanted to dominate Southeast Asia after the war. Right? So after the war, they wanted to, they went to the Soviet Union asking for support so that they could help spread socialism across Southeast Asia. But they, you know, they overreached. They were too ambitious. They did not have the ability to do that. So within a few years, they failed miserably in South Vietnam, causing, you know, so much misery and suffering to South Vietnamese. And as you know, certainly millions of, you know, Vietnamese had to flee the country because it was unlivable at the time. And they also put hundreds of thousands of personnel of former South Vietnamese government in prison for decades. So, you know, it was not Americans who were separated. It was Vietnamese, and millions of us were separated for decades because of the communist policy. So it was a tragedy for Vietnamese as well after the war. But then, you know, like, because they failed in their ambition to spread socialism and to establish socialism in Vietnam and spread socialism across Southeast Asia, they had to abandon that and then carried out economic reform, which helped Vietnam to become better today, as we know. So looking back 50 years, I think it's perhaps the U.S. overestimated the power of communism to spread, because, you know, there were many people who were against it, and, you know, not just in Vietnam but throughout Southeast Asia. So that's why they were defeated. But then they were really ambitious, and they really wanted to go as far as they could.
When it comes to who is allowed in this country, Vietnamese, the diaspora, if you will, and people that emigrated from Vietnam and fled Vietnam, how did the United States decide who got in, who didn't get in? How did they vet them, et cetera, Professor Dino?
Oh, yes. I mean, many of the, I mean, if they were, if they had ties to the former anti-communist regime, which was U.S. ally, the U.S. leaders felt that they had to provide support for them. And secondly, it was a humanitarian crisis, you know, when millions were trying to flee Vietnam and hundreds of thousands were dying in the sea. President Carter really supported helping the Bow people, and that was humanitarian cause.
How does that compare with what the U.S. is facing immigration-wise today?
It was a great crisis, but then the process was conducted legally. You know, so U.S. representatives would fly to the go to the camp, refugee camps, and interview refugees and decide, you know, who would be eligible for immigrating to the U.S. And so it was a completely legal process going through, you know, from the Congress, congressional decision to, you know, kind of government policy through the legal process to bring the refugees here, unlike the, you know, the process today, which happened very chaotically at the border.
Do you know how many Vietnamese people did ultimately wind up in the United States? Originally, of course, obviously, since then, they've had kids who have had kids who have had kids. But do you have any idea?
I think about 130,000 people came in after during 1975, and another 2 million coming during the next two or three decades.
Why do you think the Vietnamese people did so well in this nation? And for generally speaking, again, individuals are different. Groups are not. You can look and see what groups did. Generally speaking, the Vietnamese did very well in this country, did they not?
I think it's a mixed picture. Many have done very well, but many have also struggling, mm-hmm. have been struggling to make ends meet. So many remain poor and rely on public support, but many have become very successful.
What is life like in Vietnam today?
Life is much, much better in Vietnam today compared to when I was there back in the 80s. So economic reform has brought benefits, and the government also, like I said, abandoned the communist revolution, give people more freedom to make economic decisions, also freedom to travel, inviting a foreign investment into the country, and so on. So like that really improved the lives of millions of Vietnamese.
So ultimately, when it comes to the United States-Vietnamese relations, are we treat them as a friendly country, and are we now, with the balance of trade, are we now approaching maybe a not-so-friendly relationship with Vietnam?
I think U.S.-Vietnam relations continue to evolve, you know, from being very hostile to being more friendly. And even though the trend is that the two countries have become more friendly, there are, you know, big economic issues and other issues to settle. Mm-hmm. And the tariff, decision by President Trump is one of those. And so Vietnam has benefited a lot from the trade surplus with the U.S. And that can be seen as a loss to the U.S., but that also, you know, a loss for Vietnamese too, because if they can take this as an opportunity to reform the economy, to be less dependent on cheap, low-skilled labor, you know, to process Chinese goods to be re-imported to the U.S., then, you know, it would help the country in the long term.
And that gets me to my next question, which is, what is it about the economy? Is it exchange rate? What is it about Vietnam where it's hard for the United States to compete with Vietnam when it comes to manufacturing? And you're saying primarily they're manufacturing Chinese goods, and that's to avoid tariffs or to avoid it appearing as though they're Chinese goods? Take me through that, Professor.
Right. So they are mostly assembling, not manufacturing. The Chinese and the Koreans and the Singaporeans, they ship their semi-finished goods to Vietnam to be assembled and packaged and then export to the U.S. And for China, that was a way to avoid tariff from the U.S. So Vietnam has benefited from that, but mostly, you know, very little. So they could do a lot better by, you know, training their workers so that their workers can take on more advanced technology and engage in more productive activities. But I'm sorry, I have to go.
No, I understand. Right now, I appreciate it. I appreciate your time. I really do appreciate the information. That's Professor Tung Vu, Professor of Political Science, Director of U.S. Vietnam Research Center at the University of Oregon. And you got to wonder what would have happened given now what we know about the Chinese, and especially after Korea, if the United States had committed everything they had to winning the war in Vietnam. Would the Chinese have gotten involved? How involved would they have gotten? And would that have led to some type of nuclear conflict? We'll never know. We'll take a break. We come back. We'll talk to Ricky Boyette about the spillway and the river and more here on WWL. Hi, 943, 17 till 10, final day of April 2025. Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by Ricky Boyette, Chief of Public Affairs for the Army Corps of Engineers, New Orleans Division. It's the time of year where we watch the river and wonder about the spillway and so forth. Morning, Ricky. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm okay. Tell me what's going on with the river and the spillway and levels and so forth.
So, the last 5 or 6 days, we've been taking our measurements up around Red River Landing, which is the last point where any water can leave the river. And we're seeing levels come in lower than what were initially forecasted, levels low enough that while it will be closed, we're not going to see the trigger for operating the Bonnecarry Spillway.
So that's interesting that it's the last area before the water can, because after Red River, you know what's coming, right? There's no place else for it to go.
That's exactly right. Once we have made our diversion at Old River into the Atchafalaya to keep the 70-30 split, mm-hmm. The last place it's going from there is into the Gulf. And so it gives us, at least a 2-day window where we see the water, and then it takes about 2 days for it to get from that point to where the Bonnecarry is.
How high is it now, Ricky? Because I've not been to the levee. Last time I was there a couple of weeks ago, I was driving some golf balls in the river, which they told me I shouldn't do, which I won't. But and there was a lot of batcher. Now is it like to the top of the levees or not?
It's not to the top of the levees. It's around 16 and a half feet today. Mm-hmm. Rule of thumb is when we operate Bonnecarry, it usually crests out around 17 feet. So we do have the room in there, and we also build freeboard into the levee system in New Orleans. So really at the Carrollton Gauge, you know, we're looking at a crest of 17, but we have levees that are 20 to 23 feet high.
So when it comes to other things that could change, more rainfall and everything that drains into the Mississippi, do you factor that in the forecast too? Or does this mean we're out of the woods for the entire season? Take me through that.
You're exactly right. When we're looking at a forecast for the river, what you're really looking at is all the different rivers, whether it be the Ohio River or the White River, Arkansas River. We're looking at what these rivers are doing because we know ultimately that water is going to enter the Mississippi. What we are seeing is while the crest is going to come in a little lower, it's going to come in longer. So originally, we were looking at a peak of about a day and then start to fall. That's being extended out. So we're going to be in a flood fight for most of May. And then, of course, we have to continue to watch, you know, what rain falls in the Red River area or the Ohio. Because if we're at a high river and then we get more rain, well, then that has effect on not only duration, but a potential rise again.
So tell me how this affects the saltwater intrusion and the wedge and so forth. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? And then also when you talk about the flood fight, what exactly does that mean? And because the physics of this is you got the pressure against the levees over a period of time and the flow of the river. Take me through all of that, Ricky, if you would.
Sure. With the saltwater intrusion, that's only an extreme low water situation. So as the river is pushing out, it's got enough force to keep the Gulf out into the Gulf. It's not allowing that to come in. So we have no saltwater coming into the Mississippi right now. With the flood fight, the key is you're exactly right. It's the system, even though we're not operating Bonnecarry, is under a lot of pressure. So the Corps, as well as the levee districts, are out every day, and we're looking for anything that could become a problem before it's a problem. And obviously, you know, that can be seepage or sand boils, but it's also small things that can grow into a big thing. I like to use an armadillo can create a seepage path overnight. So we want to identify it as soon as possible. And we'll need to do that as long as the river is above 11 feet.
So is there anything people should be looking for?
Absolutely. You know, especially when you're looking at the river system in New Orleans, they're used as recreation as much as they are flood fighting. So people are walking it or riding their bikes every day. And if they see anything unusual, by all means, give us a call. But we're looking for, you know, if there is a barge that's parked close to the levee or if someone's doing work. You know, a lot of times when we talk about all work has to stop, people are thinking big construction projects, but it could be somebody needs to fix their sewage line. Or in one case, we had someone was planting tulips at the toe of the levee, and that means they're digging into the ground. Mm-hmm. So it's all of those things that we're looking for. And we have a commitment that if you report it to us, we will have someone go look at it.
So I guess when it comes to the Bonnie Carey spillway, we can say it's not – what can we say, Ricky? I'm trying to get a handle on his timeline and so forth. When do we know yet, really, or just for now?
It's for now because we don't know what rain and that will happen in the valley over the duration of what we consider a high water season that really goes till June. Right now, the flows that were expected are coming in a little lower, as well as the elevations are kind of being dropped through the National Weather Service. So we do not see reaching our trigger of 1.25 million cubic feet per second moving through New Orleans. Put that in a different way. It would be about 9 million gallons passing through New Orleans every second. That is what our levee system is designed to hold. We do not see that right now, but it's close. And so conditions can change in the future. But right now, it's a positive trend that we hope continues.
Is there such a thing as to say when we will have the all clear?
If the river, yes, in that, you know, as the river begins to drop and we're coming closer to the end of the in the flood fight season, you can be more confident that water and rain in the valley will not affect the river so greatly. So as long as it's high, we're going to be on alert. But then as it starts to fall, then, you know, you get a lot more confidence that the high water season itself is coming to a close.
And I get a text real quick from somebody worried about navigation and ships running into the levee and so forth. What kind of a concern is that?
It is a concern. You know, we're always watching. We work very closely with the Coast Guard to ensure as the river gets bigger and it gets faster, it becomes more challenging to navigate. Fortunately, we have good partners with the Coast Guard that are, you know, ensuring that the safe rules are being applied. We did have those barges that in Baton Rouge area come up. They were able to remove the Pontchartrain Levee District was immediately on site. They've got it backed up. The initial review that we're continuing for that section of the levee is it's in good shape.
Someone texted in a meeting of the Association of Levee Boards in Baton Rouge this week. Will you be attending that, and what's going to happen there?
So twice a year, the levee, all the levee districts gather together. They do in the spring. They also do in December. We do participate. Our team participates as well as our commander will give an update during the early morning session tomorrow morning.
So we want to hope for not a lot of rain upriver, correct?
That's right. I would say we want to hope for not a lot of rain all at one time in the river. You know, the river is big, and those that are feeding those tributaries, those rivers that are feeding it, are a lot smaller than Mississippi, so we can handle a lot more water than most places. But if it all happens at one time, that's where you start to see the kind of rise that we saw this year. Is because in early April, we had what some were reporting a generational rain event happening in many places simultaneously.
Thank you, Ricky. Appreciate the information. Chief of Public Affairs for the Army Corps of Engineers, New Orleans Division, Ricky Boyette. Quick reminder, it's a town hall with President Trump in his first 100 days, moderated by Chris Cuomo from News Nation with Bill O'Reilly, Stephen A. Smith. Don't miss it tonight from 7 till 9 right here on WWLAMFM.com and the free Odyssey app. Newell's coming up next. Oh, real quick, some unfinished business. That was Peter Griffin before that you heard, not a league of their own. It was Peter Griffin about the Who Are You game. Knowles next. We'll see what he's got for us when we come back. WWL.